At Public.com, you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. And while we can't say it's officially the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's higher than Robinhood, SoFi, Wealthfront, Capital One, and the big banks, too. Ready to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash? Check out the high-yield cash account on Public.com. This is paid for by Public Investing. 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosure/high-yield-account.
Hey, if you're listening to this, I will assume you're at least interested in money, understanding the economy, and finances as well. And some of us now want to get the next generation interested as well. So check out Million Bazillion, Marketplace's award-winning kids podcast that breaks down money to help dollars make more sense. Tune into Million Bazillion wherever you find your favorite podcasts. A whole new season is out now. Million Bazillion is presented in partnership with Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Greenlight helps kids and teens learn to earn, save, spend wisely, and invest. Get 1 month free and an extra $10 when you sign up for a Greenlight account at greenlight.com/million. The throwaway line here, of course, is you can't fire me, I quit. A more sophisticated approach would be to say that corporate America has some issues with the President of these United States. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Ryssdal. It is Wednesday, the 16th of August. Good as always to have you along, everybody. There's a saying about financial crises that goes like this. They happen very, very slowly and then all at once. I mention that because today we had a hybrid business and political crisis for the President of the United States that unfolded slowly at first and then unraveled in a big, big hurry. CEOs of some of the biggest companies in America, after saying the past 2 days they simply had to stay on two of the president's various White House cancels so that they could, to quote one of them, participate in the discussion on how to drive growth and productivity in the United States, changed their minds. As more CEOs started dropping out this morning and after the members of those councils decided amongst themselves to disband, the president said he was going to end them anyway. Thank you very much. Rachel Abrams is one of our Friday regulars. She's also at the New York Times. Hey, Rachel.
Hey there.
Is it going too far to say, at least for today anyway, that corporate America seems to be distancing or divorcing itself from President Trump?
I don't think that's going too far. It certainly seems like some of the biggest CEOs in the president's orbit are really recalibrating how closely associated they want to be with the president. Normally, these advisory councils are really prestigious seats at the table for CEOs, and it has seemed more and more that these CEOs find this association to be increasingly a liability given all of the backlash against how the president has handled certain recent events, including and, of course, mostly his response to the events in Charlottesville this past weekend.
You have to look at this, well, many lenses, but one that lends itself right away is the idea that President Trump was the businessman president. He was the CEO president who now can't get CEOs to sit down in the same room with him.
Right. And I think that the business community has really viewed him as being business friendly. I don't know whether he's been truly accepted by the Wall Street community, for example. Mm. We've written a lot about how Wall Street, especially after some of his company's bankruptcy and financial troubles, banks were very hesitant to lend to him. But in terms of whether the business community embraced him as a president, I think we can certainly say that they were very optimistic that he would enact policies that would be very business friendly. He would certainly, corporations are looking to him for tax reform purposes. Specifically, they're really interested in corporate tax reform, yeah, lowering the corporate tax rate. But I think that as we've seen Republicans really stumble to get legislation passed, I think that the optimism that there are going to be big legislative wins that will benefit the business community, I think that optimism is waning. And I think that at the same time, there's this growing risk of being associated with a president. And the idea is that the CEOs will get a seat at the table, they'll get access to the president, and the ability to help shape an agenda is worth whatever backlash the CEOs might get.
just because this is the way things seem to go with this president, that something happens and he turns around, pretends it almost didn't, and then 6 months later, you know, he turns it somehow to his advantage. It's possible that by, like, Christmas, they could be buddies again.
I mean, anything's possible. It's impossible to predict the future. I feel like all these CEOs are just trying to figure out, is this ultimately more beneficial than it is harmful? And I think for them to feel like association with the president is more beneficial, they're going to have to get something in return for that association. And I don't know if they've really seen that yet.
Rachel Abrams at the New York Times. Thanks, Rachel.
Thank you.
Once again, traders took the news of this day and said, "Feh." We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Whether the president's able to regroup with corporate America or not, the global economy within which we all operate is not the one that the president prefers. We were telling you yesterday about a bet that people in South Carolina made a generation ago on luxury German cars, a bet that's paid off pretty well.
It was a blessing that BMW came here. That helped us understand the international community and also opportunities. Just see what's happened to us in 25 years.
30,000 jobs, billions of dollars in corporate investment, and that's just a start. But remember that the winning economic argument in the election last November was that globalization wasn't working and that it would be better for the American economy if we were less a part of things. That is emphatically not the case, though, in some parts of this country. And that's the theme of the series we've got going on globalization, the goods and the not-so-goods. It's called Trade-Off. If you're driving an X-Series BMW, or you see one next to you on the way to the Piggly Wiggly, it was made in a factory in upstate South Carolina. 30% of those cars stay in the United States. The other 70% make a stop on their way out to the global economy here at the Port of Charleston, where they're driven off specially equipped railroad cars one by one.
It can be organized chaos.
That's Adam Henderson. He's the Ro-Ro manager at the port. That stands for roll-on, roll-off cargo.
We have to keep up with the pace. We'd like to target 100 cars an hour.
And they're parked here.
We've got about 70 acres of vehicles.
Until a ship comes in, and then they're driven aboard again one by one.
If all three ships are working at the same time, it's a beehive.
In charge of it all is Port of Charleston CEO Jim Newsom. They're setting records here for the cargo volume they're moving, part of which is these BMWs.
So they go everywhere. So they go to Germany, they go to Europe, China, Asia. The only ones that don't move through here are Australia, New Zealand, and some of the Middle East.
And all of this is here because it makes economic sense to build a luxury German car in upstate South Carolina for export to the rest of the world using Americans who used to work in textile factories to do it.
Well, I think that people are best, you know, people in countries should focus on what they do best. That's the David Ricardo theory, you know, what everyone shouldn't try to do everything.
Can't tell you how much I love to hear David Ricardo name-checked by a guy I'm interviewing. Ricardo's up there with Adam Smith and the pantheon of founders of modern economics for coming up with the idea of comparative advantage. Not every country should make everything, the theory goes. Everybody makes what they're best at or makes most efficiently, and then we all trade for the rest and everybody prospers. Or if you want to think about it another way, a global economy means incomes have risen not just here but in the rest of the world so that consumers in emerging economies can afford to buy what we make.
And I think globalization is sort of the rising tide that lifts all boats, basically.
So the theory goes. But unless you haven't been listening to this program, like, at all, you know that whole globalization lifting all boats thing. While, yes, actually being the big picture reality is not everybody's individual experience.
There are a whole bunch of people in this country who think globalization is the worst thing that ever happened in the American economy.
Well, I mean, you know, I think it depends on your perspective. If you happen to be in an industry that's not thriving through globalization and you have the unfortunate circumstance of losing your job from that, then I think you would see globalization as a bad thing. But I think the reality of life is that more industries prosper through globalization than suffer.
And that
gets us back to where we were yesterday, Spartanburg County in the upstate and the biggest BMW factory in the world, just off I-85 on a campus that really wouldn't look out of place in Silicon Valley.
Hi, I'm Sherry Kuntz-McCurl.
Tell us where we are.
We're in the middle of the Assembly North at BMW Manufacturing in Spartanburg, South Carolina.
Off we go.
All right.
It's spotlessly clean. It's enormous, busy, but orderly all at the same time.
We started the plant pretty small, and then we were able to build this assembly, another paint shop, additional body shops.
It's a $10 billion investment by BMW that rolls out almost 500,000 cars a year, 70% of which, again, are sold outside the United States.
How many people, plus or minus, work in this building?
About 5,000.
You say that like it's nothing. I mean, that's like a whole town.
It is. It's bigger than my hometown, for sure.
Yeah.
Sherry McCraw is the chief financial officer at BMW Spartanburg, but she started back in the day as an engineer. She's got badge number 39. She was the 39th person hired at this plant.
I was doing textiles. I was in the tech services group. It was a little bit the end of the whole textile era, and so we were working on trying to automate factories and come up with better ways to do business, to be more competitive.
Do you remember where you were when you heard that BMW was coming to Spartanburg?
I was actually working in Greenwood, South Carolina. I was doing a project down there, and I would drive past on Highway 85, and I would see the billboard that came up in the middle of a peach orchard, I guess. The sign was planted on the side of the highway. It said, Future Home of BMW Manufacturing. And I looked at the sign every day as I would pass by, and I would think, that's really cool. I could travel to Germany, I could get European travel, and I could do engineering work for a cool company. So.
And she wasn't the only person in textiles who saw opportunity in the form of an application to work at BMW.
We had rooms and rooms and rooms of resumes. Resumes as tall as the ceiling in an entire room of the building where we were working. You couldn't even sort through them, but it was thousands and thousands of resumes.
So these cars over there, I mean, I don't even know what they're doing. They're putting in some kind of molding and back window or something.
This
right?
is the glass cell. So
I
we're installing
right.
the, you
I,
know,
I
we installed
I,
the front glass
right.
and the rear glass. She's putting in the trim pieces to hold the glass in place.
The woman over there who's doing the glass assembly, though.
Yes.
She's a beneficiary of globalization, but there are many in this country and in this economy who aren't.
Yes.
What are your thoughts about the people who see globalization differently?
It's hard for me to understand. It really is very difficult for me to understand what is the true problem with globalization, because trying to be competitive and trying to create a capitalist market system, it's difficult to say, okay, it doesn't make sense to sell to other markets, or it doesn't make sense to only sell in the United States. So for me, it's kind of it's so difficult to understand that perspective. I'm not really sure where they're coming from. I mean, you really, if you see all the benefits from being able to sell everywhere and be able to buy from every place, it's to me, it's just a difficult discussion.
But it's a discussion President Trump wants to have. Pulling back from the global economy is one of the few economic policies the administration is actually making progress on. And whether you're in Spartanburg or Greenville, it can be easy to forget that globalization doesn't always work out the way it's supposed to. Just think about that carrier plant in Indiana, for one example. But here in South Carolina, globalization's made life pretty good for a whole lot of people.
You're welcome. Y'all come on in and have a seat.
Great.
Can I get you some water?
This is the Suits family on a Tuesday night. Brett Suits shows us into the living room.
I joined BMW in the first year that they were here. I'm associate number 50.
I'm Allison Suits. I'm Brett's wife.
You teach German too, right?
I have been a German teacher. Not currently.
There's Bella, the family dog. Brett and Allison have three kids. Two of them are here.
I'm Molly Suits, and I'm Brett's daughter. I am a special education teacher, so I followed my mom's footsteps.
And Jacob, wearing the same BMW polo his dad's got on.
Work at BMW, obviously, with the shirt, and have been in production and engineering.
You've got to be like 9,300 and something, right?
Oh, well, you're pretty close.
Yeah. So dad's 50.
I am 9,593.
Oh, that's pretty good,
you're
right?
Really
that's
close.
Pretty good guess.
Yeah.
Yeah, so they'll get to 10,000. Are they at 10,000 yet? Do you know?
Yes.
BMW helped shape this family. They took a transfer to Germany for a couple of years when the kids were young.
I think we traveled to 11 different countries while we were there and really tried not to leave any stones unturned.
They learned German as good as, or maybe better than, Allison.
I can understand Bayerisch, or the local dialect of Munich, more than even she can.
Oh, yeah.
And when you ask Molly and Jacob about BMW and how much it's changed this area?
Yeah, I guess I wonder if maybe you guys
take it a little bit for granted because it's the way it's always been for y'all growing up around here. I mean, the BMW plant has always been there, and you don't even actually think about it anymore.
Probably. I mean, it's like having a BMW. Like, my dad's always had a brand new BMW.
And since you were two. Jacob has ridden in a BMW since he was two.
And so when people, you know, it's a privilege, but I didn't realize that until I got in the real world and was like, oh, not everybody has a brand new BMW all the time.
So many of my students and their families are employed by BMW or by one of their suppliers. And so I see how that really impacts me as a teacher and my students, because they can have health care, they have better support at home, and then my students are going to be more successful because of that.
And if Brett has his way, BMW and the global economy are going to be here when he is long retired and it's Jacob's generation's turn.
We need to make sure that that group is prepared to take over the organization and lead it to better things than even we've been able to. Some of that selfish, because in retirement I need to continue getting my pension. But really, it's for the community, because this is something that isn't a one or two generation wonder. We intend to make this long term.
And that's what puts this family and its economic future at odds with the way the President of the United States sees this country and this economy. Because globalization hasn't worked everywhere, but it's worked here in upstate South Carolina. And sometimes, made in America is more complicated than it seems.
We make German cars in America.
Yeah.
I agree. Yeah. It's a German car. Yeah. Das Automoto, right?
That's the
Well, it's got... It's...
Look, globalization is difficult, and not everybody's going to come out ahead. But the days of not being part of the global economy, they're long gone. We've got our whole series on globalization, Trade-Off, it's called, as well as pictures from inside that BMW factory and a brand new video about some of the winners and losers on our website. It's marketplace.org. Coming up.
I think what they want to see is something more optimistic. They want Hidden Figures. They don't want Detroit.
Race and culture in America after Charlottesville. But first, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrials up 25 points today, about a 10%, closed at 22,024. The NASDAQ up 12, 10% there as well, 6,345. S&P 500 up 3 points. Yes, once again a 10%, 24,068. Brighter day for retail today. Target shot up 3.6%. Urban Outfitters up 17.4%. Both posted second quarter sales that beat expectations. Gap ramped up about 2.25% today. Sliding oil brought energy stocks down. Occidental and Marathon Petroleum were off 1.5% apiece. ExxonMobil down about 0.7%. Healthcare rallied. Biogen up 2.1%. Anthem up 0.1%. Banks stumbled after indications in the minutes of their last meeting that the Federal Reserve is wary of raising interest rates. Bank of America down 1.1% today. Oh, by the way, NAFTA negotiations started today. Renegotiations, I should say. Bond prices rose. Yield on the 10-year T-note fell to 2.22%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Looking for the highest interest rate on your cash? At Public.com, you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. And while we can't say it's officially the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's a higher rate than Robinhood, a higher rate than SoFi, a higher rate than Marcus, a higher rate than Wealthfront, frankly, a higher rate than Capital One, a higher rate than Ally, a higher rate than Barclays, a way higher rate than Bank of America and Chase, a higher rate than Citi, Wells Fargo, Discover, and it's a higher rate than American Express, too. So if you want to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash, check out Public.com. We can't say it's the highest interest rate, but it's pretty darn up there. This is paid for by Public Investing. 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosure/high-yield-account.
And now a word from our sponsors at Betterment.
Do you want your money to dream big? Do you want your money to be a total self-starter? Are you annoyed that your money doesn't work hard enough? Don't worry. Betterment is here to help. Betterment is the automated investing and savings app that makes your money hustle. Their automated technology is built to help maximize returns. Meaning, when you invest with Betterment, your money can auto-adjust as you get closer to your goal. Rebalance if your portfolio gets too far out of line. And your dividends are automatically reinvested. That can increase the potential for compound returns. In other words, your money is breaking a sweat while you can be breaking bread. You'll never picture your money the same way again. Betterment, the automated investing and savings app that makes your money hustle. Visit Betterment.com to get started. Investing involves risk. Performance is not guaranteed.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. There is tech news of note today, which comes to us in a simple three-word phrase, original video content. Apple is said to be planning a big push, $1 billion worth, to stream its own shows on Apple TV and Apple Music. It's a crowded field, as we all know. Netflix, Amazon, Hulu, for starters, also traditional cable like HBO as well. Marketplace's Amy Scott has more on that one.
Apple's already dipped a toe into original content with new shows like Planet of the Apps and Carpool Karaoke. The latest episode features Metallica. Netflix and Amazon better sleep with one eye open, because apparently that's just the beginning. The Wall Street Journal reports Apple plans to acquire and produce as many as 10 shows. Analyst Tuna Amobi with CFRA says $1 billion is a relatively small investment. Netflix will spend $6 billion this year.
But over the long term, I think it's just going to intensify the competition for talent and for consumers.
As popular as on-demand video is, it's not yet a very profitable business, which is why Dan Rayburn with research firm Frost & Sullivan thinks Apple is making a different play to draw more customers into the Apple ecosystem.
I see this as them using original content to promote other services like the music service they have, as opposed to just trying to compete directly with the same type of offering that others have in the market.
Still, a big hit out of the gate could go a long way, says analyst Ben Beharin with market research firm Creative Strategies.
They need something that gets people in the door, and then after that, continue to have things that they can watch.
A blockbuster like Game of Thrones is unlikely, he says, but Apple's name and deep pockets could be a big draw for talented producers. I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
Violence in Charlottesville this past weekend, and the president's response, and then his second response, and then his third response, has brought a whole bunch of things in this society and this economy to the surface. Stuff that is troubling to think about and sometimes hard to talk about, as race and racism can be. Wesley Morris is a culture critic at the New York Times. He is also the co-host of the podcast Still Processing. Hey, man.
Hi, Kai. What's going on?
Well, you know, some stuff.
Well, what isn't going on?
That's right. Some stuff. There's some stuff going on. So let me tell you why we called you, all right? I was listening to you and Jenna Wortham on Still Processing the other day, the podcast that you two do. And you guys came back from vacation because of Charlottesville and because of all the stuff that's been going on. And you had a good, long, solid conversation about it. And it got me to thinking about how this might manifest itself in the culture. And while acknowledging all the sensitivities about what's going on, do you think this will show up in our culture?
I think the spirit of protest is going to show up around the culture, right? I think that there's a direct effect that protests can have on an unpleasant thing that the protesters find objectionable.
Well, yeah, but then if you get it back to what happened in Charlottesville and all that entails, what comes out of those protests and how will we see it, right? I mean, as you sit down 6 months from now to write your retrospective culture piece on this, right?
Yes. I think one thing I would point to is the degree to which people who consume culture kind of don't want this in their culture, right, in the first place. I think the reason Dunkirk has been such a hit, aside from the fact that it's very well made, is because it is dramatizing a kind of heroism and leadership that I think a lot of people are desperate to experience again. And that is, in its way, kind of spiritually satisfying. I think we'll probably get more things like that than we will Detroit, which is a movie that, in its well-meaning, is wants to take on an aspect of the moment that we're currently in, dealing with issues of white supremacy, dealing with issues of systemic racism in the United States. I don't think people want to see that. I think what they want to see is something more optimistic. They want Hidden Figures. They don't want Detroit.
And that's part of what's happening here, right? Our inability to want to see that then gets reflected in culture, and it gets reflected in the movies that get made, and it gets reflected in all of those things. And it perpetuates a thing that Black Americans have been living with for 250 years.
Yeah. And I also don't know whether or not the movies or television, or I don't know, no one is obligated to directly confront this. I actually am more interested in things where it just shows up. For instance, in the case of The Bachelorette this summer, one of the big characters on that show was this guy named Lee, who wasn't officially a racist on the show, but he definitely had a thing for this guy Kenny, one of the Black contestants, and he seemed to dog him in this very coded way that read in racist terms. And as it turns out, he had some tweets that he posted a couple years ago that basically confirmed what people suspected. But the show turned him into a centerpiece for at least half its run.
Because of ratings and profit and
yes,
all of that.
Yes, yes. I mean, but they took this deplorable guy and they made a star of him for as long as he was around on the show.
So clearly you watched The Bachelorette, by the way. I'm just saying.
Guilty
I'm
as
just
charged.
Saying. Wesley Morris, he writes on culture and a bunch of stuff for The New York Times. Thanks, man.
Thank you.
Final note on the way out today from the Marketplace desk of Boy, Life Comes at You Fast. We told you up the top that as late as Monday afternoon, most CEOs on the White House Manufacturing Council were saying that they were going to stay on those councils. The president went after the CEOs who were leaving with a tweet that said, quote, "For every CEO that drops out of the Manufacturing Council, I have many to take their place. Grandstanders should not have gone on. Jobs! Exclamation point." End of quote. Alex Gorsky, the CEO of Johnson & Johnson, said Tuesday that J&J was deeply saddened and that intolerance, racism, and violence have no place in our society. But in the end, I have concluded that Johnson & Johnson has a responsibility to remain engaged, end of quote. Fast forward to today, 15 minutes after the president's tweet about ending the councils, and Gorsky said this: "The president's most recent statements have changed our decision to participate in the White House Manufacturing Advisory Council," end of quote. Remember, that came after the president had said they were done. All right, we're done. The Dow up 25 today, about a 10%, 22,024. NASDAQ gained 12 points, about a 10% as well. Finished at 6,345. The S&P 500 up 3 points, a 10%. One more time, ended at 2,468. Brian Allison, Chris Clark, Jake Gorsky, Chris Morocco, Jeff Peters, Daniel Ramirez, and Charlton Thorpe engineered the broadcast for us. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We'll see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money.
Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.